As a general, Napoleon made it his habit to delay responding to the mail. His secretary was instructed to wait 3 weeks before opening any correspondence. When he finally did hear what was in a letter, Napoleon loved to note how many supposedly important issues had simply resolved themselves and no longer required a reply. While Napoleon was certainly an eccentric leader, he was never negligent in his duties or out of touch with his government or his soldiers. But in order to be active and aware of what actually mattered, he had to be selective about who and what kind of information got access to his brain. In a similar vein, he told messengers never to wake him with good news. Bad news, on the other hand, that is to say an unfolding crisis or an urgent development that negatively impacted his campaign, was to be brought to him immediately. "Rouse me instantly," he said, "for then there is not a moment to be lost." These were both brilliant accommodations to the reality of life for a busy person. There is way too much coming at us. In order to think clearly, it is essential that each of us figures out how to filter out the inconsequential from the essential. It's not enough to be inclined toward deep thought and sober analysis. A leader must create time and space for it. In the modern world, this is not easy. In the 1990s, political scientists began to study what they called the CNN effect. Breathless 24-hour media coverage makes it considerably harder for politicians and CEOs to be anything but reactive. There's too much information. Every trivial detail is magnified under the microscope. Speculation is rampant, and the mind is overwhelmed. The CNN effect is now a problem for everyone, not just presidents and generals. Each of us has access to more information than we could ever reasonably use. We tell ourselves that it's part of our job, that we have to be on top of things, and so we give up precious time to news, reports, meetings, and other forms of feedback. Even if we're not glued to a television, we're still surrounded by gossip and drama and other distractions. We must stop this. "If you wish to improve," Epictetus once said, "be content to appear clueless or stupid in extraneous matters." Napoleon was content with being behind on his mail, even if it upset some people or if he missed out on some gossip, because it meant that trivial problems had to resolve themselves without him. We need to cultivate a similar attitude, give things a little space, don't consume news in real time, be a season or two behind on the latest trend or cultural phenomenon. Don't let your inbox lord over your life. The important stuff will still be important by the time you get to it. The unimportant will have made its insignificance obvious or have simply disappeared. Then, with stillness, rather than needless urgency or exhaustion, you will be able to sit down and give what deserves consideration your full attention. There is ego in trying to stay up on everything, whether it's an acclaimed television show, the newest industry rumor, the smartest hot take, or the hottest crisis in the Middle East, Africa, Asia, the climate, the World Bank, the NATO summit, ad infinitum. There is ego in trying to appear the most informed person in the room, the one with all the gossip, who knows every single thing that's happening in everyone's life. Not only does this cost us our peace of mind, but there's a serious opportunity cost, too. If we were stiller, more confident, had the longer view, what truly meaningful subject could we dedicate our mental energy to? In her diary in 1942, Dorothy Day, the Catholic nun and social activist, admonished herself much the same. "Turn off your radio," she wrote. "Put away your daily paper. Read one review of events and spend time reading. Books. Spend time reading books." That's what she meant. Books full of wisdom. Though this too can be overdone. The verse from John Ferriar. "What wild desires, what restless torments seize the hapless man who feels the book disease." The point is, it's very difficult to think or act clearly, to say nothing of being happy, when we are drowning in information. It's why lawyers attempt to bury the other side in paper. It's why intelligence operatives flood the enemy with propaganda, so that they'll lose the scent of the truth. It's not a coincidence that the goal of these tactics is casually referred to as analysis paralysis. Yet we do this to ourselves. A century and a half after Napoleon, another great general and later head of state, Dwight D. Eisenhower, struggled to manage the torrent of facts and fiction that was thrown at him. His solution was a strict adherence to the chain of command when it came to information. No one was to hand him unopened mail. No one was to just throw half-explored problems at him. Too much depended on the stillness within that he needed to operate to allow such a haphazard information flow. One of his innovations was to organize information and problems into what's now called the Eisenhower box, a matrix that orders our priorities by their ratio of urgency and importance. Much of what was happening in the world or on the job, Eisenhower found, was urgent but not important. Meanwhile, most of what was truly important was not remotely time-sensitive. Categorizing his inputs helped him organize his staff around what was important versus what seemed urgent, allowed them to be strategic rather than reactive, a mile deep on what mattered rather than an inch on too many things. Indeed, the first thing great chiefs of staff do, whether it's for a general or a president or the CEO of a local bank, is limit the amount of people who have access to the boss. They become gatekeepers. No more drop-ins, tidbits, or stray reports. So the boss can see the big picture. So the boss has time and room to think. Because if the boss doesn't, well, then nobody can. In his Meditations, Marcus Aurelius says, ask yourself at every moment, is this necessary? Knowing what not to think about, what to ignore and not to do, it's your first and most important job. Thich Nhat Hanh. Before we can make deep changes in our lives, we have to look into our diet, our way of consuming. We have to live in such a way that we stop consuming the things that poison us and intoxicate us. Then we will have the strength to allow the best in us to arise, and we will no longer be victims of anger, of frustration. It's as true of food as it is of information. There's a great saying, garbage in, garbage out. If you want good output, you have to watch over the inputs. This will take discipline. It will not be easy. This means fewer alerts and notifications. It means blocking incoming texts with the Do Not Disturb function and funneling emails to subfolders. It means questioning that open door policy or even where you live. It means pushing away selfish people who bring needless drama into our lives. It means studying the world more philosophically, that is, with a long-term perspective, rather than following events second by second. The way you feel when you wake up early in the morning and your mind is fresh and as yet unsoiled by the noise of the outside world, that space worth protecting. So too is the zone you lock into when you're really working well. Don't let intrusions bounce you out of it. Put up barriers. Put up the proper shooting to direct what's urgent and unimportant to the right people. Walker Percy, one of the last great Southern novelists, has a powerful passage in Lancelot based on Percy's own struggle with idleness and addiction to entertainment. In the book, the harried narrator walks outside of his Mississippi mansion and for the first time in years simply stops. He steps outside his bubble and experiences the moment. Can a man stand alone, naked and at his ease, wrist flexed at his side like Michelangelo's David, without assistance, without diversion, in silence? He asks. Yes, it was possible to stand. Nothing happened. I listened. There was no sound, no boats on the river, no trucks on the road, not even cicadas. What if I didn't listen to the news? I didn't. Nothing happened. I realized I had been afraid of the silence. It is in this stillness that we can be present and finally see truth. It is in this stillness that we can hear the voice inside us. How different would the world look if people spent as much time listening to their conscience as they did to chattering broadcasts? If they could respond to the calls of their conviction as quickly as we answer the dings and rings of technology in our pockets. All this noise, all this information, all these inputs. We are afraid of the silence. We are afraid of looking stupid. We are afraid of missing out. We are afraid of being the bad guy who says, nope, not interested. We'd rather make ourselves miserable than make ourselves a priority, than be our best selves, than be still and in charge of our own information diet. Empty the mind. To become empty is to become one with the divine. This is the way. Awa Kenzo. Sean Green began his third season with the Los Angeles Dodgers in 2002 in the worst slump of his Major League Baseball career. The media was out for blood, and so were the fans who booed him at the plate. Dodgers management began to doubt him too. The man was making $14 million a year, and he could not hit. After weeks of intense hitting famine, would he be benched, traded, sent down to the minors? All this was racing through Green's mind as it would race through the mind of anyone struggling at work. That little voice, what's wrong with you? Why can't you get this right? Did you lose your touch? Hitting a baseball is already a nearly inconceivable feat. It requires the batter to see, process, decide, swing at, and connect with a tiny ball traveling at speeds north of 90 miles per hour from an elevated position 60 feet away. 400 milliseconds. That's how long it takes for the ball to travel from the mound to the batter. To be able to swing at and hit it literally defies physics. It is the single hardest act in all of sports. The anxiety and doubts in a slump make it even harder. Yogi Berra's warning, it's impossible to hit and think at the same time. For Green, the ball began to look smaller and smaller the longer he went without a hit. But it was Buddhism, which he had long practiced, that Sean leaned on to prevent this vicious cycle from destroying his career. Instead of giving in to those churning thoughts, instead of trying harder and harder, he tried to clear his mind entirely. Instead of fighting the slump, he was going to try not to think about it at all. It seems crazy, but it isn't. Man is a thinking reed, D.T. Suzuki, one of the early popularizers of Buddhism in the West, once said. But his great works are done when he is not calculating and thinking. Childlikeness has to be restored with long years of training in the art of self-forgetfulness. When this is attained, man thinks, yet he does not think. The way out of the slump wasn't to consult experts or redesign his swing. Sean Green knew he had to get rid of the toxic thinking that had knocked him off his game in the first place. The thinking about his big contract, the expectations for how he wanted the season to go, the stress at home or the critics in the media. He had to push all that out of his mind. He had to let his training take over. On May 23rd, 2002, Green was struggling to do exactly that. It was the rubber match in a series against the Brewers. The Dodgers had eked out a 1-0 victory the night before and lost the night before that. Green's own hitting was sporadic and discouraging, so when he got to the ballpark that morning, he worked to give himself a fresh start. first in the batting cage and then at the batting tee, he slowly, patiently, quietly cleared his mind. With each swing, he tried to focus on the mechanics, the placement of his feet, really planting himself where his feet were, not thinking of the past, not worrying about what was coming in the future, not thinking about the fans or how he wanted to hit the ball. Really, he wasn't thinking at all. Instead, he repeated an old Zen proverb to himself, chop wood, carry water, chop wood, carry water, chop wood, carry water. Don't overanalyze, do the work. Don't think, hit. In his first at bat that day, Green took two strikes in the first two pitches. His mind burbled a bit. Is the slump going to keep going? Is this ever going to end? Why can't I get this right? But he let those wild horses run right on by, waiting for the dust they kicked up to settle. He breathed in and emptied his mind again, as empty as the seats in the stadium during his pregame ritual. Then he got back to work. On the third pitch, crack, a solid double down the right field line. In the second inning, Green got an inside fastball. He planted his front foot and focused only on that, on the feeling of being nailed to the ground. He watched the pitch and swung. The ball was soon going back out the other direction, high up over the right field wall. Three runs came in along with it. In the fourth inning, he hit another homer in the walkway over right center field. In the fifth inning, he hit a home run deep into left field, opposite field, a sign that a hitter is really starting to dial in. In the eighth inning, he hit a long single. The slump was no more. 5 for 5 in his at-bats, and the manager wanted to send him home for the day. Green asked for another at-bat. Now his mind was tempted to race in a different direction, his brain filled with congratulations instead of doubts. You're killing it. How exciting is this? Are you going to get another hit? You could set a record. Just like the overactive voice in a slump, the voice in a streak is an equally deleterious racing mental loop. Both get in the way. Both make a hard thing harder. As Sean Green stepped into the batter's box for the sixth and final time, he said to himself, there's no sense in thinking now. He cleared his mind and enjoyed himself like a kid at a Little League game. No pressure, just presence, just happy to be there. On the third pitch, he got a dipping cutter that sank low and inside, below knee level. For lefties like Green, when they are in a slump, that area of the hitting zone is like a black hole. When they are locked in, it's the wheelhouse. Green connected with a swing that even one of his coaches said looked like it was happening in slow motion. Every part of the batter was behind the bat, mentally and physically, and the ball was launched deep, deep into right center field. He hit it a mile. It slammed high off the back wall of the enclosed stadium and bounced back out onto the field. As Green's teammates went nuts in the dugout, he kept his head down and rounded the bases with the same calm, deliberate trot as in his previous three home runs. You couldn't tell from the lack of celebrating, but he was, in that moment, only the 14th player in history ever to hit 4 home runs in a single game, 6 for 6 with 19 total bases and 7 runs batted in, perhaps the single greatest one-game performance in baseball. The entire crowd of 26,728 people at an away game rose for a standing ovation. But Green was already clearing that all away and coming back to his routine. He took off his batting gloves and swept the experience from his mind, keeping it empty to use in the next game. Sean Green is hardly the first Buddhist baseball player. Sadaharu Oh, the greatest home run hitter in the history of baseball, was one too. The goal of Zen, his master taught him, was to achieve a void, noiseless, colorless, heatless void. To get to that state of emptiness, whether it was on the mound or in the batter's box or at practice. Before that, Zhang Zhou, the Chinese philosopher, said, Tao is in the emptiness. Emptiness is the fast of the mind. Marcus Aurelius once wrote about cutting free of impressions that cling to the mind, free of the future and the past, to become the sphere rejoicing in its perfect stillness. But if you saw those words in the first paragraph of the write-up for the Dodgers-Brewers game in the Los Angeles Times the next day, they would have made perfect sense. Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius's philosophical predecessor, was in fact speaking about sports when he said, if we're anxious or nervous when we make the catch or throw, what will become of the game? And how can one maintain one's composure? How can one see what is coming next? As is true in athletics, so too in life. Yes, thinking is essential. Expert knowledge is undoubtedly key to the success of any leader or athlete or artist. The problem is that unthinkingly, we think too much. The wild and whirling words of our subconscious get going, and suddenly there's no room for our training or anything else. We're overloaded, overwhelmed, and distracted by our own mind. But if we can clear space, if we can consciously empty our mind, as Green did, insights and breakthroughs happen. The perfect swing connects perfectly with the ball. There is a beautiful paradox to this idea of void. The Tao Te Ching points out that when clay is formed around emptiness, it becomes a pitcher that can hold water. Water from the pitcher is poured into a cup, which is itself formed around emptiness. The room this all happens in is itself four walls formed around emptiness. Do you see? By relying on what's not there, we actually have something worth using. During the recording of her album, Interiors, the musician Roseanne Cash posted a simple sign over the doorway of the studio. Abandon thought, all ye who enter here. Not because she wanted a bunch of unthinking idiots working with her, but because she wanted everyone involved, including herself, to go deeper than whatever was on the surface of their minds. She wanted them to be present, connected to the music, and not lost in their heads. Imagine if Kennedy had spent the Cuban Missile Crisis obsessing over the Bay of Pigs. Imagine if Sean Green had tried frantically to recreate his swing because it wasn't working, or if he had faced those pitchers with a racing mind filled with insecurities and desperation. We've all experienced that. Don't mess up, don't mess up, don't forget, we say to ourselves. And what happens? We do exactly what we were trying not to do. Whatever you face, whatever you are doing, will require, first and foremost, that you don't defeat yourself, that you don't make it harder by overthinking, by needless doubts, or by second guessing. That space between your ears, that's yours. You don't just have to control what gets in, you also have to control what goes on in there. You have to protect it from yourself, from your own thoughts, not with sheer force, but rather with a kind of gentle, persistent sweeping. Be the librarian who says shh to the rowdy kids or tells the jerk on his phone to please take it outside. Because the mind is an important and sacred place. Keep it clean and clear. Slow down, think deeply. With my sighted eye, I see what's before me, and with my unsighted eye, I see what's hidden. Alice Walker. In the intro sequence of the beloved children's show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, the first interior shot does not show the host. Instead, in the beat before Fred Rogers appears on the screen singing his cheerful song about being a good neighbor, viewers see a traffic light blinking yellow. For more than 30 years, And for nearly 1,000 episodes, this subtle piece of symbolism opened the show. If, as a hint, it went over the heads of most people watching, viewers were still primed to get the message. Because whether Fred Rogers was speaking on camera, playing in the neighborhood of make-believe with King Friday the Puppet, or singing one of his trademark songs, just about every frame of the show seemed to say, slow down, be considerate, be aware. As a child at La Trobe Elementary School in Pennsylvania, Fred Rogers had been a victim of vicious bullying. Kids picked on him because of his weight and because he was sensitive about it. It was a horrible experience, but this pain spurred his groundbreaking work in public television. I began a lifelong search for what is essential, he said about his childhood, what it is about my neighbor that doesn't meet the eye. He even framed a print of that idea on the wall in his production studio in Pittsburgh, a snippet from one of his favorite quotes. What's essential is invisible to the eye. That is, appearances are misleading. First impressions are too. We are disturbed and deceived by what's on the surface, by what others see. Then we make bad decisions, miss opportunities, or feel scared and upset, particularly when we don't slow down or take the time to really look. Think about Khrushchev on the other side of the Cuban Missile Crisis. What provoked his incredible overreach? A poor reading of his opponent's mettle, a rush to action, shoddy thinking about how his own actions would be interpreted on the world stage. It was a nearly fatal miscalculation, as most rush jobs are. Epictetus talked about how the job of a philosopher is to take our impressions, what we see, hear, and think, and put them to the test. He said we needed to hold up our thoughts and examine them to make sure we aren't being led astray by appearances or missing what couldn't be seen by the naked eye. Indeed, it is in Stoicism and Buddhism and countless other schools that we find the same analogy. The world is like muddy water. To see through it, we have to let things settle. We can't be disturbed by initial appearances. And if we are patient and still, the truth will be revealed to us. That's what Mr. Rogers taught children to do, starting a crucial habit as early as possible in their lives. In countless episodes, Rogers would take a topic, whether it was self-worth or how crayons were made, divorce or having fun, and walk his young viewers through what was really happening and what it meant. He seemed to naturally know how a kid's mind would process information, and he'd help them clear up understandable confusion or fears. He taught empathy and critical reasoning skills. He reassured his viewers that they could figure just about anything out if they took the time to work through it with him together. It's a message he shared with adults too. Just think, Rogers once wrote to a struggling friend. Just be quiet and think. It'll make all the difference in the world. There is, on the surface, a contradiction here. On the one hand, the Buddhists say we must empty our minds to be fully present. We'll never get anything done if we are paralyzed by overthinking. On the other hand, we must look and think and study deeply if we are ever to truly know, and if we are to avoid falling into the destructive patterns that harm so many people. In fact, this is not a contradiction at all. It's just life. We have to get better at thinking deliberately and intentionally about the big questions, on the complicated things, on understanding what's really going on with a person or a situation or with life itself. We have to do the kind of thinking that 99% of the population is just not doing. And we have to stop doing the destructive thinking that they spend 99% of their time doing. The 18th century Zen master Hakuin was highly critical of teachers who believed that enlightenment was simply a matter of thinking nothing. Instead, he wanted his students to think really, really hard. That's why he assigned them perplexing koans, like, What is the sound of one hand clapping? And what did your face look like before you were born? And does the dog have the Buddha nature? These questions defy easy answers, and that's the point. By taking the time to meditate on them deeply, in some cases for days and weeks or even years, students put their mind in such a clarified state that deeper truths emerge and enlightenment commences. And even if they don't get all the way there, they are stronger for having tried. Suddenly, Hakuin promised his students, unexpectedly, your teeth sink in. Your body will pour with cold sweat. At the instant, it will all become clear. The word for this was Satori, an illuminating insight when the inscrutable is revealed, when an essential truth becomes obvious and inescapable. Couldn't we all use a bit more of that? Well, no one gets to Satori going a million miles a minute. No one gets there by focusing on what's obvious or by sticking with the first thought that pops into their heads. To see what really matters, you really have to look. To understand it, you have to really think. And it takes real work to grasp what is invisible to just about everyone else. This will not only be advantageous to your career and your business, but it will also help you find peace and comfort. There is another great insight from Fred Rogers, which now goes viral each time there is another unspeakable tragedy. Always look for the helpers, he explained to his viewers who were scared or disillusioned by the news. There's always someone who is trying to help. The world is full of doctors and nurses, police and firemen, volunteers, neighbors and friends who are ready to jump in to help when things go wrong. Make no mistake, this was not some glib reassurance. Rogers, building on advice from his own mother when he was a child, had managed to find comfort and goodness inside an event that would provoke only pain and anger and fear in other people. And he figured out how to communicate it in a way that continues to make the world a better place long after his death. So much of the distress we feel comes from reacting instinctually instead of acting with conscientious deliberation. So much of what we get wrong comes from the same place. We're reacting to shadows. We're taking as certainties impressions we have yet to test. We're not stopping to put on our glasses and really look. Your job after you have emptied your mind is to slow down and think, to really think on a regular basis. Think about what's important to you. Think about what's actually going on. Think about what might be hidden from view. Think about what the rest of the chessboard looks like. Think about what the meaning of life really is. The choreographer Twyla Tharp provides an exercise for us to follow. Sit alone in a room and let your thoughts go wherever they will. Do this for 1 minute. Work up to 10 minutes a day of this mindless mental wandering. Then start paying attention to your thoughts to see if a word or a goal materializes. If it doesn't, extend the exercise to 11 minutes, then 12, then 13, until you find the length of time you will need to ensure that something interesting will come to mind. The Gaelic phrase for this state of mind is quietness without loneliness. If you invest the time and mental energy, you will not only find what's interesting or your next creative project, you will find truth. You'll find what other people have missed. You'll find the solutions to the problems we face. Whether it's insight to the logic of the Soviets and their missiles in Cuba, or how to move your business forward, or how to make sense of senseless violence. These are answers that must be fished from the depths. And what is fishing but slowing down? Being both relaxed and highly attuned to your environment, and ultimately catching hold of what lurks below the surface and reeling it in. Start journaling. Keep a notebook travel with it, eat with it, sleep with it, slap into it every stray thought that flutters up into your brain. Jack London. For her 13th birthday, a precocious German refugee named Anne Frank was given a small red and white autograph book by her parents. Although the pages were designed to collect the signatures and memories of friends, she knew from the moment she first saw it in a store window that she would use it as a journal. As Anne wrote in her first entry on June 12, 1942, "I hope I will be able to confide everything to you, as I have never been able to confide in anyone, and I hope you'll be a great source of comfort and support." No one could have anticipated just how much comfort and support she'd need. 24 days after that first entry, Anne and her Jewish family were forced into hiding in the cramped attic annex of her father's warehouse in Amsterdam. It's where they would spend the next 2 years hoping the Nazis would not discover them. Anne Frank had wanted a diary for understandable reasons. She was a teenager. She had been lonely, scared, and bored before, but now she was cooped up in a set of cramped, suffocating rooms with six other people. It was all so overwhelming, all so unfair and unfamiliar. She needed somewhere to put those feelings. According to her father, Otto, Anne didn't write every day, but she always wrote when she was upset or dealing with a problem. She also wrote when she was confused, when she was curious. She wrote in that journal as a form of therapy, so as not to unload her troubled thoughts on the family and compatriots with whom she shared such unenviable conditions. One of her best and most insightful lines must have come on a particularly difficult day. "Paper," she said, "has more patience than people." Anne used her journal to reflect. How noble and good everyone could be, she wrote, if at the end of the day they were to review their own behavior and weigh up the rights and wrongs. They would automatically try to do better at the start of each new day, and after a while would certainly accomplish a great deal. She observed that writing allowed her to watch herself as if she were a stranger. At a time when hormones usually make teenagers more selfish, she regularly reviewed her writings to challenge and improve her own thinking. Even with death lurking outside the doors, she worked to make herself a better person. The list of people, ancient and modern, who practiced the art of journaling is almost comically long and fascinatingly diverse. Among them, Oscar Wilde, Susan Sontag, Marcus Aurelius, Queen Victoria, John Quincy Adams, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Virginia Woolf, Joan Didion, Sean Green, Mary Chestnut, Brian Koppelman, Anais Nin, Franz Kafka, Martina Navratilova, and Ben Franklin. All journalers. Some did it in the morning. Some did it sporadically. Some, like Leonardo da Vinci, kept their notebooks on their person at all times. John F. Kennedy kept a diary during his travels before World War II, and then, as president, was more of a note-taker and a doodler, which is shown in studies to improve memory, on White House stationery, both to clarify his thinking and keep a record of it. Obviously, this is an intimidating list of individuals. But Anne Frank was 13, 14, 15 years old. If she can do it, what excuse do we have? Seneca, the Stoic philosopher, seems to have done his writing and reflection in the evenings, much along the lines of Anne Frank's practice. When darkness had fallen and his wife had gone to sleep, he explained to a friend, "I examine my entire day and go back over what I've done and said, hiding nothing from myself, passing nothing by." Then he would go to bed, finding that the sleep which follows this self-examination was particularly sweet. Anyone who reads him today can feel him reaching for stillness in these nightly writings. Michel Foucault talked of the ancient genre of hupam nomada, notes to oneself, He called the journal a weapon for spiritual combat, a way to practice philosophy and purge the mind of agitation and foolishness and to overcome difficulty, to silence the barking dogs in your head, to prepare for the day ahead, to reflect on the day that has passed. Take note of the insights you've heard. Take the time to feel wisdom flow through your fingertips and onto the page. This is what the best journals look like. They aren't for the reader. They are for the writer, to slow the mind down, to wage peace with oneself. Journaling is a way to ask tough questions. Where am I standing in my own way? What's the smallest step I can take toward a big thing today? Why am I so worked up about this? What blessings can I count right now? Why do I care so much about impressing people? What is the harder choice I'm avoiding? Do I rule my fears or do they rule me? How will today's difficulties reveal my character? And by the way, if you want a journal with prompts, you can check out the Daily Stoic Journal, which is written by me and published by Portfolio. While there are plenty of people who will anecdotally swear to the benefits of journaling, the research is compelling too. According to one study, journaling helps improve well-being after traumatic and stressful events. Similarly, a University of Arizona study showed that people were able to better recover from divorce and move forward if they journaled on the experience. Keeping a journal is a common recommendation from psychologists as well because it helps patients stop obsessing and allows them to make sense of the many inputs, emotional, external, psychological, that would otherwise overwhelm them. That's really the idea. Instead of carrying that baggage around in our head or our hearts, we put it down on paper. Instead of letting racing thoughts run unchecked or leaving half-baked assumptions unquestioned, we force ourselves to write and examine them. Putting your own thinking down on paper lets you see it from a distance. It gives you objectivity that is so often missing when anxiety and fears and frustrations flood your mind. What's the best way to start journaling? Is there an ideal time of day? How long should it take? Who cares? How you journal is much less important than why you are doing it. To get something off your chest, to have quiet time with your thoughts, to clarify those thoughts, to separate the harmful from the insightful. There's no right way or wrong way. The point is just to do it. If you've started before and stopped, start again. Getting out of the rhythm happens. The key is to carve out the space again today. The French painter Eugène Delacroix, who called Stoicism his consoling religion, struggled as we struggled. I am taking up my journal again after a long break, he said. I think it may be a way of calming this nervous excitement that has been worrying me for so long. Yes, that is what journaling is about. It's spiritual windshield wipers, as the writer Julia Cameron once put it. It's a few minutes of reflection that both demands and creates stillness. It's a break from the world, a framework for the day ahead, a coping mechanism for troubles of the hours just past, a revving up of your creative juices for relaxing and clearing. Once, twice, three times a day, whatever, find what works for you. Just know that it may turn out to be the most important thing you do all day. Cultivate silence. All profound things and emotions of things are preceded and attended by silence. Silence is the general consecration of the universe. Herman Melville. The fascination with silence began early in life for the composer John Cage. In 1928, in a speech contest for Los Angeles High School, he tried to persuade his fellow students and the judges that America should institute a national day of quiet. By observing silence, he told the audience, they would finally be able to hear what other people think. It was the beginning of Cage's lifelong exploration and experimentation with what it means to be quiet and opportunities for listening that this disciplined silence creates. Cage wandered after high school. He toured Europe. He studied painting. He taught music. He composed classical music. He was an avid observer. Born in 1915 in California, he was just old enough to remember what pre-mechanized life was like. And as the century became modern and technology remade every industry and occupation, he began to notice just how loud everything had become. Wherever we are, what we hear is mostly noise, he would say. When we ignore it, it disturbs us. When we listen to it, we find it fascinating. To Cage, silence was not necessarily the absence of all sound. He loved the sound of a truck at 50 miles an hour, static on the radio, the hum of an amplifier, the sound of water on water. Most of all, he appreciated the sounds that were missed or overwhelmed by our noisy lives. In 1951, he visited an anechoic chamber, the most advanced soundproof room in the world at the time. Even there, with his highly sensitive musician's ear, he heard sounds, two sounds, one high and one low. Speaking with the engineer afterward, he was amazed to discover that the source of those sounds was his own nervous system and the pumping of his blood. How many of us have ever come close to this kind of quiet, reducing the noise and chatter around you to the degree that you can literally hear your own life? Can you imagine? What could you do with that much silence? It was a reaction against unnecessary noise that inspired Cage's most famous creation, 433, which was originally conceived with the title Silent Prayer. Cage wanted to create a song identical to the popular music of the day. It'd be the same length and played on the radio like every other song. The only difference was that 433 would be a piece of uninterrupted silence. Some people saw this as an absurd joke, a Duchampian send-up of what constitutes music. In one sense, it was. Cage thought it would be funny to sell the song to Muzak Company to be played in elevators. But it was also inspired by his lifelong study of Zen philosophy, a philosophy that finds fullness in emptiness. The performance instructions for the song are themselves a beautiful contradiction. They say, in a situation provided with maximum amplification, perform a disciplined action. In fact, 433 was never about achieving perfect silence. It's about what happens when you stop contributing to the noise. The song was first performed at Woodstock, New York, by the pianist David Tudor. There's no such thing as silence, Cage said of that first performance. What they thought was silence, because they didn't know how to listen, was full of accidental sounds. You could hear the wind stirring outside during the first movement. During the second, raindrops began pattering the roof. And during the third, the people themselves made all kinds of interesting sounds as they talked or walked out. We were given two ears and only one mouth for a reason, the Stoic philosopher Zeno observed. What you'll notice when you stop to listen can make all the difference in the world. Too much of our lives is defined by noise. Headphones go in, noise-canceling headphones so that we can better hear noise. Screens on, phones ringing, the quiet metal womb of a jumbo jet traveling at 600 miles per hour is filled with nothing but people trying to avoid silence. They'd rather watch the same bad movies again and again, or listen to some inane interview with an annoying celebrity, than stop and absorb what's happening around them. They'd rather close their mind than sit there and have to use it. Thought will not work except in silence, Thomas Carlyle said. If we want to think better, we need to seize these moments of quiet. If we want more revelations, more insights or breakthroughs or new big ideas, we have to create more room for them. We have to step away from the comfort of noisy distractions and stimulations. We have to start listening. In downtown Helsinki, there is a small building called the Kamppi Chapel. It's not a place of worship, strictly speaking, but it's as quiet as any cathedral. Quieter, in fact, because there are no echoes, no organs, no enormous creaking doors. It is, in fact, a church of silence. It's open to anyone and everyone who is interested in a moment of quiet spirituality in a busy city. You walk in and there's just silence. Glorious, sacred silence. The kind of silence that lets you really start hearing. Randall Stutman, who for decades has been the behind-the-scenes advisor for many of the biggest CEOs and leaders on Wall Street, once studied how several hundred executives of major corporations recharged in their downtime. The answers were things like sailing, long-distance cycling, listening quietly to classical music, scuba diving, riding motorcycles, and fly fishing. All these activities, he noticed, had one thing in common, an absence of voices. These were people with busy, collaborative professions, people who made countless high-stakes decisions in the course of a day. But a couple hours without chatter, without other people in their ear, where they could simply think or not think, they could recharge and find peace. They could be still, even if they were moving. They could finally hear, even if over the sounds of a roaring river or the music of Vivaldi. Each of us needs to cultivate these moments in our lives, where we limit our inputs and turn down the volume so that we can access a deeper awareness of what's going on